The history of Black Canadians can be traced back to the 17th century and includes immigrants from Africa, the United States, the Caribbean, and the British West Indies. In pre-Confederate Canada, slavery was a fact of life, documented as early as 1628. The first Black settlers in Kingston were United Empire Loyalists and the slaves of Loyalists. Many Blacks fought with the British in the American Revolution, which lasted from 1776 to 1783. The British enticed slaves to enlist by promising them their freedom and land in Canada. Upper Canada was the first British territory to enact anti-slavery legislation in 1793. Called the Upper Canada Abolition Act, this legislation decreed that no more slaves could enter Canada, and children born to slaves after the law was passed were to be released when they reached the age of 25. In 1833, slavery was abolished in all British colonies under the British Imperial Act. These legal reforms, combined with increasing pressure in the United States, such as the implementation of the Fugitive Slave Act, encouraged Blacks to escape to Canada. The American Civil War started in 1861, but the second wave of Black immigrants, mainly fugitive slaves, came to Canada as early as the 1840s. During the early to mid-1800s, tens of thousands of Blacks escaped slavery and came to Canada via the Underground Railroad. By 1860, there were as many as 40,000 Blacks in Ontario. However, when the Civil War ended in 1865, many Blacks left Upper Canada to return to the United States, drawn by the Reconstruction and relatives they had left behind. This movement is evidenced by the decrease in Kingston's Black population, documented in 1861 at 106 and dropping to 102 by 1871. The fugitive slaves who came to Kingston during the late 1800s had a low socioeconomic status. Many had no possessions and little or no education. They were in competition for employment with the Irish, Kingston's poorest group. The 1861 census reveals that many Black men were employed as laborers, barbers, cooks, and sailors. At that time, several Black women were employed as domestics, washerwomen, and dressmakers. Due to Kingston's small size, there was a degree of integration not always seen in larger cities. There was no Black neighborhood in Kingston, and the Black population was dispersed throughout the city. There were also no segregated schools in Kingston, and the 1871 census records 29 Black children attending local schools. This is unusual, as racially segregated schools existed in Ontario until the 1960s. Organ and Melodeon Factory, 112 Gore Street. This quiet residential street was at one time quite busy. It was the site of both residences and businesses. Joseph George owned one of these businesses, which was located here at 112 Gore Street. While this is the original site of his business, the original building from the period is no longer standing. Joseph George was a successful Black businessman during the 19th century. Known as a builder, carpenter, and lumber merchant, Joseph was born in the 1820s in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. His first wife, Isabella, was born in England. Joseph's occupation is listed as a carpenter, builder, and lumber merchant, starting in 1855. He remained a carpenter by trade over the next 15 years. In 1867, he started selling flour and seed in addition to working as a builder. Joseph continued in these trades until May 1, 1872. On this date, he announced in the newspaper that he had bought a partnership from Joseph Rayner in the Organ and Melodeon Factory. The other partner in this company was Charles Mee, and the business was known as Mee & Company. Joseph remained in the piano business for the next 25 years. His partnership with Charles Mee lasted almost a decade. After that, he continued on his own, but still remained at the Gore Street location he had shared with Charles Mee. Joseph's business specialized in organs and pianofortes, but by 1885, he had expanded to include sewing machines. Joseph's dedication to his community was shown by his 1881 donation of an organ worth approximately $250 Canadian to Queen's University. The university placed this gift in Convocation Hall. Joseph was also dedicated to helping those who were less fortunate. He bought rundown houses and rented them out to poor people in the community. As well, he supported the local Children's Aid Society and the Orphan's Home. Joseph passed away in 1910, survived by his second wife, Abby. He was remembered as a successful businessman and active member of the Kingston community. Telegraph Hotel and Livery of Clarence Street. Lord Clarence Street was right in the center of the city during the 19th century. At that time, this street benefited from the wharfs off Ontario Street, as well as Market Square and City Hall close by. This was a busy location filled with hotels, wharfs, businesses, and wholesalers, all profiting from the ships that came in daily. As such, this was the perfect location for George Mink to open his Telegraph Hotel and Livery. George Mink was one of the city's most renowned black businessmen. He was descended from slaves brought to Kingston during the American Revolution by well-known loyalist Johann Jost Herkimer. George was an eminent Kingston citizen, owner of a well-established livery stable and saloon. In addition, he was recognized for his leadership and contributions to the community. The 1848 British Whig characterized George as, quote, a colored man, but who has a soul as big as that of the whitest man in Christendom, end quote. George is first mentioned in the British Whig in May 1838, advertising his business, New Livery Stables, which was located at the head of Brock Street. George received positive press, praised by the Chronicle and Gazette for his introduction of the new London cab, which they wrote was, quote, a style worthy of the capital of the province of Canada, end quote. George's business was extremely successful, and he expanded his livery stable throughout the 1840s, eventually moving to a larger location here on Clarence Street in 1848, where he was to remain for 15 years. The Telegraph Hotel and Livery was the name of his new location, situated in a stone house where George had on hand, quote, stage extras, covered wagons, double wagons, light buggies, and saddle horses, end quote, available any time, day or night. George ran stage lines and omnibuses between Kingston and surrounding locations. He was also the recipient of several mail contracts starting in 1846. In addition to George's business success, he was also seen as a leader in Kingston's black community. In 1842, he held a meeting for the improvement of the colored population at his house, attended by several prominent members of the anti-slavery movement. The meeting ended with the establishment of a committee, of which George was one of two black members. In the 1850s, George's leadership capacity was also attested to when a signed requisition appeared in the British Whig requesting that he run as alderman of the Ontario ward. The British Whig commented, quote, the presence of a respectable, well-conducted man like George Mink, though a man of color, would be a comparative credit to the coming board, end quote. However, this request soon became a scandal as confusion surrounded the issue. Many people felt that it had been a joke for the electors to nominate George because of his race. George eventually declined the offer and sent a public letter to the Angus detailing his reasons. Primarily, he believed that some of the signers of the requisition had done so only to further their own success. However, had George become alderman, he would have been the first black man elected to public office in Upper Canada. Kingston City Hall. Built in 1844, this building at one time was not only the site of the municipal government, but also rented space to banks, stores, and saloons in the mid-1800s. Two successful black entrepreneurs owned one of the businesses that rented space here in City Hall, James and Maria Elder. James Elder was a successful black entrepreneur in Kingston during the mid-1800s. With his wife Maria, James ran the Oregon Saloon, a popular Kingston establishment that was located in this area and famous for serving oysters, fresh fruit, and the best wines. Prior to their arrival in Kingston, the origins of the Elders are unknown. They are first documented here due to the tragic death of their young son, George Alexander, who died in 1832. It is possible that they had arrived in the city prior to this date. However, Like many of the black settlers in Kingston from that time period, there is simply a lack of documentation to answer our questions. It is likely that the elders came to Kingston by one of three means. Either they were descendants of slaves who came to Canada with their loyalist masters during the 1780s, fugitive slaves who escaped from the United States, or else free blacks that immigrated to Canada. James and Maria Elder evidently believed in the importance of education. Both are found on the first subscription list for the establishment of Queen's University at Kingston in 1840. They were also concerned with the education of blacks in Canada. Along with George Mink, James was one of two black committee members appointed to an 1842 committee concerned with establishing a manual training school in Canada for black citizens. The purpose of the committee was to form a society for the improvement of the colored population in Kingston. The elders were also kept busy by their successful business. The Oregon Saloon announced in 1847 that it was moving to a new location on Ontario Street, opposite the Martello Tower. This central location was described by the British Whig as, quote, an advantageous position, end quote, from which the saloon, quote, will do a good business, end quote. James was praised as an honest, painstaking proprietor worthy of such success. The newspaper also details that the saloon was, quote, fitted up in good taste, end quote. However, merely a year later, tragedy struck as a fire destroyed the business. Despite the setback, a year later, the Oregon Saloon was open again on Ontario Street. Fires were common during this period. As reported by the British Whig, the elders were reduced to poverty three times because of fires. The elders also coped with great personal tragedy during their lifetime. After the death of their son George Alexander, they witnessed the deaths of five more of their children, all before 1850. James Elder, described in the British Whig as a, quote, worthy and industrious citizen, end quote, predeceased his wife and died in 1853 at the age of 61. Maria continued to run the saloon with great success for the next few years. Later in 1854, the saloon was operated out of rented space in Kingston City Hall. Maria died in 1859 when she was 49 years old. The Oregon Saloon was subsequently taken over by their son-in-law, John Jackson, who had married their oldest daughter, Mary Maria, in 1852. Barber and hairdresser. Chronicle Building, second door from the corner on Brock Street, north side of Market Square. William Johnson is one of the earliest black entrepreneurs documented in Kingston. He was a successful barber and hairdresser who served the community for over 55 years. His barbershop was located two doors from the corner on Brock Street on the north side of Market Square, placing it in this large white building formerly referred to as the Chronicle Building. This building was twice damaged by fire, most recently in 1850. Afterwards, it was rebuilt by the famed Kingston architect William Coverdale. One of the largest and most imposing buildings on this block, this building used to be mirrored by two other white brick constructions also designed by William Coverdale. One was located on the other side of King Street East on the corner, while the other was located where the Bank of Montreal now stands. Together, these three buildings served to frame the area around Market Square with City Hall, emphasizing the civic importance of this site. William is mentioned in the Kingston Chronicle and Gazette as early as 1829 in an advertisement for his business as a barber and hairdresser. Like many other business owners, William fell prey to fires that often broke out during this period. In all, fires destroyed his shop no less than four times. In 1833, William's business was located on the westerly side of King Street until it fell prey to fire that burned both Brock and King Streets that year. By 1835, William was advertising his business in Market Square. Again, tragedy struck on April 18, 1840, when a fire destroyed his shop, forcing him to move to Center Street. 2 months later, he relocated and set up his business on Brock Street. The year 1841 was much happier for William, as he was married to Lavina Stewart of Kingston in St. George's Cathedral. Their wedding was presided over by George O'Kill Stewart, rector of the church. This was also the year that William served on the committee for the British Wesleyan Missionary Association. With his wife Lavina, George had a daughter Clarissa, who sadly died at age 3. William also fathered a son, who grew up to enter his trade, eventually becoming the barber of Sir John A. Macdonald. William's barbershop remained at its Brock Street location for 5 years, moving back to Market Square in 1845. This is where his business remained until his death in 1881. On May 25th, the Daily British Whig published an obituary for the late William Johnson. The article praises William for being, quote, honorable and upright in his daily life, exemplar in his business life, devout and liberal in his church life, end quote, and, quote, surely a good Christian, end quote. Slavery was very much a part of pre-Confederate Canada. The practice was legal in New France, which became Upper and Lower Canada in 1791. The history of black slaves in Kingston begins with the United Empire Loyalists who came to this area at the time of the American Revolution. Many of these Loyalists owned slaves and brought them to Canada when they crossed the border, as they were considered personal property. Slavery was legal here, and thus these slaves continued to work under their masters. Many notable Loyalists in Kingston owned slaves, such as the Everetts, Herkimers, Fairfields, and Cartwright families. Reverend John Stewart, the minister of St. George's Church, was a Loyalist who also brought his slaves with him from the United States. Molly Brant owned 3 slaves, Abraham Johnson, Jubba, and Jane Fonda. Her famed brother, Mohawk chief Joseph Brant, owned between 30 and 40 black slaves. Slavery began to decline in 1793 as a result of the Upper Canada Abolition Act, which, quote, prevented the further introduction of slaves, end quote. However, the notion of blacks as slaves was not erased so easily. Many Loyalist wills from the 1790s list slaves as personal property. William Jerry Henry, fugitive slave. Many fugitive slaves sought freedom in Canada during the 1800s. One of Kingston's fugitives was famous in New York State, but lived a quiet life upon his arrival in Canada. This was William Henry, a man who went by the name of Jerry. Jerry was a barrel maker working in Syracuse who had previously escaped a life of slavery in the South. In 1850, the Fugitive Slave Act was passed, which allowed for slaves living in free states in the North to be captured and returned to their owners. However, at that time, Syracuse was a hotbed of emancipation and abolitionist sentiment. In 1850, Jerry was arrested at work under false pretenses and later charged under the Fugitive Slave Act. At the very same time in Syracuse, the convention for the Anti-Slavery Liberty Party was underway. In a short time, local abolitionists and convention members had been informed of Jerry's arrest. By a prearranged signal, church bells rang all across town as both blacks and whites stormed the commissioner's house where Jerry was being held. The crowd managed to release Jerry into the streets, but was quickly recaptured. However, they were not deterred. They regrouped and later stormed the jail again, finally forcing the police to release Jerry. He was hidden in the city with a local abolitionist for several days before being smuggled across Lake Ontario and into Canada, finally settling in Kingston. While in Kingston, Jerry worked for Chester Hatch, a local furniture maker. Jerry died in Kingston on October 8, 1853. His historic rescue was forever known as the Jerry Rescue, an important event in Syracuse's history with an interesting link to Kingston. Former site of the stagehouse, Princess Street. This 3-story brown brick building was built in 1841. It was advertised in the Kingston Chronicle the next year, described as, quote, fireproof, end quote. This was where George Mink relocated his business to in the 1860s. During the 1850s, the completion of a rail line through to Kingston from Montreal to Toronto negatively impacted George's business success. Now that the train was available, demand for the mail and coach service disappeared. However, George seized on new opportunities and negotiated with the Grand Trunk Railroad Company to run his omnibuses from the station, transporting customers between Kingston hotels and the station. This resulted in a price war between George and the other cabs in the city, all of which were competing for the same business at increasingly low prices. This competition continued to the detriment of the cab owners for several years. This also led to violence between the different cab companies, and during these years, George faced the destruction of his property, physical violence, and harassment. Despite George's success during the beginning of his career, the 1860s were characterized by poor luck and small returns. In 1863, he auctioned off his horses, carriages, cutters, sleighs, and household furniture as financial difficulties forced him to move from his Clarence Street location. He opened a tavern on Princess Street called the Stage House. However, the city directory for 1865 still lists him as a cabman and livery stable proprietor. George had several encounters with the law beginning that year and continuing, as he was charged for selling liquor and driving a cab without the necessary licenses. However, his tavern remained open until 1870, and George was last documented as renewing his cab license in 1871. He died in 1873 at the age of 64 and was forgotten by the local news. His second wife, Mary, stayed in Kingston for several years, working as a dressmaker and living on Princess Street before leaving Kingston for Detroit. The 1861 census for Kingston shows a high proportion of interracial marriages between black men and Irish women. For example, James Maxwell Cook, age 63, born in the United States, whose wife is listed as M. Maxwell, age 43, born in Ireland. Alan Shepherd, a barber born in the United States, age 52, married to Mary Shepherd, age 24, born in Ireland. And William Canada, a tailor, age 42, married to Eleanor Canada, age 25, born in County Cavan, Ireland. Interracial marriage was a reality of the day in Kingston. However, it was still a controversial issue in the city. The majority of Kingston's black citizens were in competition for employment with Kingston's poverty-stricken Irish population. Before long, Kingston's female Irish population saw black men as extremely eligible bachelors. This did not go unnoticed, as evidenced by several articles that appeared in the Whig during the 1860s. These voiced opinions against mixed marriages, opinions expressed by prominent citizens such as the Whig's publisher, Dr. E.J. Barker. While Dr. Barker made it clear that he was against slavery, his writing applies a double standard to all blacks in Kingston, implying that it was, quote, immoral, end quote, for Irish women to intermarry. Despite the condemnation and prejudice voiced in the Whig, one could assume, because of the prevalence of interracial marriages in Kingston, that this practice was accepted by the majority of citizens. Former site of Queen's University, 203 William Street. In 1844, Queen's University moved into these two stone houses before us. Between the establishment of the university in 1842 and the year 1853, Queen's lacked a permanent home and moved several times in search of appropriate accommodations. As the school grew, it needed a location that would fulfill its expanding needs. George Brown, the famed architect who designed Kingston City Hall, built this house as his private residence in 1841. He sold it to Queen's 3 years later, and the university used half of the building for its college classes and the other half for its preparatory school. By 1847, two more houses were added to the original holdings, one served as a boarding house, the other for classrooms. In 1849, Robert Sutherland arrived at the university, one of the 14 members of the class of 1852. Typical of Queen's students of the day, Sutherland was of Presbyterian faith and had a distinctly Scottish name. However, he was also unique as Queen's only Jamaican student. In fact, Sutherland was Queen's first student of color and perhaps the first black student to study at any Canadian university. There is little information regarding Sutherland's origins. Slavery was still legal in Jamaica when he was born in the early 1830s, and it is possible that his parents were slaves on a plantation. If Sutherland had been born a slave, his status would have been tied to that of his parents and dependent on the will of their owner to grant them freedom. There is also the possibility that his father was a white plantation owner, evidenced by a letter written in 1911 by James McLennan, a friend and classmate of Sutherland from Queens, and also the executor of his will. McLennan states that Sutherland's father was a Scotchman, while Sutherland was as black as he could be. This information regarding his father remains unproven. However, if Sutherland's father was a free white man, it could possibly explain how he was able to afford to come to Canada and attend Queens. Sutherland attended Queens for 3 years, at that time the norm for completing a Bachelor of Arts degree. He had an exemplary record and was very successful academically, winning 14 academic prizes during his time in Kingston, excelling in both Greek and mathematics. He is also remembered for his public speaking skills as a member of the Dialectic Society, the Queen's Debating Club. Sutherland is recorded as stating that he was always been treated like a gentleman during his time at Queen's. In 1852, he finished with double honors in mathematics and classics, continuing on to Toronto to study law at Osgoode Hall. After being called to the bar in 1855, Sutherland moved to Walkerton, Ontario, an area that had been settled by numerous blacks. Sutherland opened a legal practice and remained in Walkerton until his death. He was the first black lawyer in Canada. Sutherland died of pneumonia in Toronto at the age of 48. Upon his death on June 2, 1878, he willed his entire estate, property, and belongings to Queen's University. This totaled approximately $12,000 Canadian, an extremely large gift for the day. This donation was the first considerable bequest to the university and remarkable as the largest donation ever made to the university by a single benefactor. As a tribute to Sutherland's memory and a gesture of thanks, the university placed a large granite tombstone on Sutherland's grave to commemorate his connection to Queen's and to demonstrate the school's gratitude. St. James Anglican Church, 10 Union Street West. A structure built in 1844, designed in the Gothic style. This is an ideal location to discuss the life of Alfred Pierce, because we have a vantage point of this church, Humphrey Hall, which is located down Arch Street, and the former location of the Jock Hardy Arena, which was on the corner of Union and Division Streets. All of these sites were significant to the life of Mr. Pierce. Born on May 24, 1874, Alfred Pierce was christened here at St. James Anglican Church. He was the son of fugitive slaves who had escaped from the United States and settled in Kingston. Better known as Alfie to generations of students at Queen's University, even those today, he was said to have personified the spirit of Queen's. His mother and father, Margaret and Albert, operated livery teams between Toronto and Kingston. Alfie grew up in the city, attending the Gordon Street Public School, which is located where Banry Hall residence currently stands. Tragedy struck when he was 12 years old, as his father died, followed 3 months later by his mother. Alfie was left an orphan and entrusted in the care of a half-brother who was responsible for him for a short time. Alfie's athletic talents were well known since he was a young boy. His association with Queen's University is said to have started in approximately 1889 at the age of 15 when he was recruited by senior athletic student Guy Curtis. He became a water boy and masseuse for the football team, but was primarily known as their mascot. Subject to the racist attitudes of the day, Alfie became the charm piece or object of amusement for the Queen's University football team of white men. According to some, Alfie was a public slave of the team. For many, Alfie was a positive aspect of Queen's athletics and certainly an integral part of Queen's football. He was an essential part of the ritual that began each game, where he greeted the team on the field and threw the football to the captain, who then led the warm-up while the cheerleaders led the crowd in cheering. In the summer, Alfie was allowed to sleep under the stands of Richardson Stadium. At that time, the stadium was located where McIntosh Quarry parking lot is today. During the winter, Alfie lived in a converted change room in the old Jock Hardy Arena. The old arena is located where Humphrey Hall currently stands, the large brown building we can see on the right side of Arch Street. This was called the Boiler Room because it also housed the building's coal furnace. In exchange for these accommodations, Alfie kept the furnace stacked with coal, acted as a night watchman, and performed general maintenance. Later on, Alfie was said to receive a $10 allowance for these duties from the Athletic Board of Control. Alfie left Queens during the years of the First World War. During this time, he was employed at Finkel's Livery at 120 Clarence Street. It is assumed that Alfie sought employment in order to avoid being drafted into the war. During this period, he slept in the livery stable on York Street. Upon returning to Queens in 1922, Alfie was forced to share his job as mascot and his winter residence with Queen Boohoo, a female black bear who has also become the team mascot. Within 2 years, Queen Boohoo was returned to a zoo because she became vicious. After this, there were 4 more bears that fulfilled the role of Boohoo, acting as the Queen's University mascot until 1950s. After suffering a stroke resulting in the paralysis of both of his arms in 1948, Alfie died after a second stroke 3 years later. He was buried beside his parents in the Church of England Cemetery at Cataraqui. During his lifetime, Queens created the Alfred Pierce Award, annually recognizing the best first-year male and female athletes at the university. As well, the campus pub was renamed Alfie's in his memory in 1981 until 2013, when it was renamed the Underground. Grant Hall, University Avenue. Built in 1905, this historic building is named after former Queens principal George Monroe Grant. During the First World War, from 1914 to 1918, this building was used as a military hospital to house and treat wounded soldiers. Queen's School of Medicine openly admitted black students during the early 1900s. Many of these students came from the Caribbean, and it's thought that they were encouraged to venture north by Dr. James Nyesh. Dr. Nyesh was a former member of the Queen's Medical Faculty who had subsequently settled in Jamaica. The black medical students appear to have been well integrated into campus life, participating in student clubs, politics, sports teams, and appearing on academic prize lists. Friction arose at the end of the First World War in 1917. Tension grew between the black medical students and soldiers who had just returned to Canada being treated in Grant Hall. The soldiers were vocal in protesting being treated by black students, some even going so far as to insist that only white students be allowed to treat them. These racist attitudes spread and were picked up by others in the community who also complained. The medical faculty was facing increased pressure at that time as there existed a patient shortage. Many medical students were finding it increasingly difficult to complete their clinical rotations because of this. As well, it was known to the medical faculty that both University of Toronto and McGill University had faced similar complaints and were closing their medical schools to black students. Secure knowing that they were solving the problem of the patient shortage and acting in unison with the 2 other major Canadian universities at the time, Queen swiftly rid the university of these black students. Not merely those in 4th and 5th year completing clinical courses, but all black students in the faculty, asking them to continue their studies elsewhere. This resolution was pushed through the University Senate without criticism and passed in January 1918. The students who found themselves in the unfortunate position of being admitted from the university did not protest. There was an absence of documentation detailing where they ended up, but it is assumed that most were transferred to larger cities that had greater black populations, such as Dalhousie University in Halifax, where faculty had recommended their transfer. Sadly, black students were not readmitted to Queen's University Medical School until after the Second World War. Canada was characterized as a place of freedom for blacks during the American Civil War. The country was even known as the New Canaan because of the freedom that many blacks sought here. However, Canada was not free of racism or discrimination against its black immigrants. Due to Kingston's small size, the black community was integrated, as evidenced by the interracial marriages that occurred between black men and Irish women. Another sign of the extent of black integration into the community is the positive press that many black businessmen received in the local newspapers. However, there is also evidence of the presence of both overt and systemic racism in the community. This is seen through the treatment of black students enrolled in Queens Medical School in 1918. This is also shown by the outcry that arose over the nomination of George Ming for alderman. Blacks have also faced discrimination from the Canadian government. It was not until 1962 that racial discrimination was eliminated from Canadian immigration laws when the government implemented a point system based on merit. Thus, more blacks were able to immigrate to Canada. Finally, in the 1960s, the federal government adopted an official policy of multiculturalism. Racism is still an unfortunate presence today in Kingston, Ontario. As seen on our tour, the black community has a long history here in Kingston. The city's black population continues to grow and evolve from these origins. The last major wave of black immigration to Kingston occurred in the 1960s after the Canadian government implemented the point system of immigration, a merit-based immigration system that did not discriminate against non-Europeans. This change in immigration was seen across the country as the majority of black immigrants coming to Canada during the 1960s were from the Caribbean. Historically, our black citizens have contributed greatly to the community, especially in the areas of business and community leadership. It is important to recognize their significant contributions to the development of our city and their continued presence today.